Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present economist Dean Baker, who assesses Mitt Romney's pick of Paul Ryan as his running mate and what it may mean for a substantive national debate on the future of Medicare in this year's presidential election campaign. Scott Klinger with the Institute for Policy Studies, who examines the data presented in his group's new report titled Executive Excess 2012, The CEO Hands in Uncle Sam's Pocket. And David Lockbaum of the Union of Concerned Scientists, who discusses the wider implications of a Connecticut nuclear power plant shutdown due to record high ocean temperatures. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The British bank Standard Chartered agreed to pay the New York State Department of Financial Services $340 million to settle charges that it laundered $250 billion in transactions with Iran and lied to regulators. The settlement, agreed to a day before the bank faced a hearing on its New York charter, was a big win for New York State bank regulator Benjamin Losky. He announced his case by revealing a number of embarrassing emails only a week before the settlement. Critics say his public case and blasting Standard Chartered as a rogue institution undercut a five-year federal investigation of the British bank for violating U.S. law that imposes financial sanctions against Iran. In the weeks leading up to the charges in New York, the Justice Department was close to deciding not to prosecute Standard Chartered, viewing the bank's 60,000 transactions with Iran as mostly legal, reports the New York Times. Now, federal prosecutors are under pressure to bring charges against the British bank, which made a $5 billion profit in 2011 and holds $800 billion in assets. The U.S. Justice Department is facing general criticism for its failure to prosecute cases against banks. Former U.S. Treasury Enforcement Chief Jimmy Gurulé commented, "No bank official has been prosecuted. It makes me wonder if the banks have gone from too big to fail to too big to prosecute." Cotton and corn farmers in Georgia have faced severe drought conditions since 2007. 30 years ago, nearly all of the Peach State's farmers used dry or non-irrigated farming techniques. But now the farmers are nearly all irrigated, which is putting pressure on water aquifers. In Dooley County, Georgia, one of the driest places in the U.S., farm production increased by $40 million in 2011. According to the Christian Science Monitor, all across the American South, the move toward irrigation has raised concerns over depleted water resources. The U.S. Geological Survey has declared that central Georgia is experiencing long-term groundwater depletion, similar to depleted aquifers in Texas, California's Central Valley, Kansas, and Nebraska. Concern over groundwater depletion has led Arkansas to urge chicken farmers to disconnect from municipal water supplies. Yet other states like Alabama, one of the wettest states in the country, has boosted tax incentives for using farm irrigation. Depleted water levels have led to disputes between Georgia, Alabama, and Florida over control of the water flowing down the Chattahoochee and Flat River systems. In Florida, river levels have fallen to record lows, with eco-activists blaming lax farm irrigation policy in neighboring states. The Vermont Progressive Party is one of the few viable third-party movements in the United States which has shaped public policy, such as Vermont's single-payer framework for health care reform. The party grew out of the movement to elect Bernie Sanders mayor of Burlington, Vermont's biggest city in the late 1970s. The Progressive Party controlled City Hall in Burlington for most of the last 30 years, creating innovative policy on housing and other issues. Sanders moved on to win a seat as an independent in the U.S. House and is now serving as Vermont's junior U.S. senator. Since 1990, 16 Progressive Party activists have been elected to Vermont state legislature. They provided critical leverage to pressure Governor Peter Shumlin, a Democrat, to embrace legislation calling for a single-payer health care system, which could save the state $10 billion in projected health costs. Martha Abbott, a former Progressive Party candidate for state auditor, told the news magazine In These Times, "Our strategy of working on both challenging and working with Democrats makes us somewhat unique." In contrast, Vermont's traditional left third parties, like the Greens or the Liberty Union Party, have failed to win local political campaigns. These groups are politically isolated as they rally around ideological platforms while being ignored in public debates. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
presumed Republican Party presidential nominee Mitt Romney announced his pick of Wisconsin Representative Paul Ryan as his running mate on August 11th, much of the media coverage focused on the choice as a possible catalyst that could move the country toward a substantive debate on the future of Medicare and other social safety net programs. As House Budget Chair, Ryan was the architect of a 2011 budget plan that would have made dramatic cuts to funding for education, Head Start, aid to college students, and other vital social programs, while simultaneously providing ever larger tax cuts to the nation's wealthiest citizens. But perhaps Ryan's best-known signature policy proposal was to end the Medicare program as the nation has known it since its establishment in 1965. Under Ryan's plan, Medicare would move to a voucher program offering seniors a limited amount of money to shop for private health insurance while shifting the burden of thousands of dollars of additional health care costs onto the elderly the program serves. Under the current Medicare system, the government directly pays doctors, hospitals, and other health care providers. Your reporter spoke with economist Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, columnist, and author. He assesses the view that Mitt Romney's pick of Paul Ryan as his running mate could provoke a substantive national debate on the future of Medicare and austerity economics in this year's presidential election campaign.
Well, these are, I think, views most people consider pretty extreme. I mean, in the past, Representative Ryan has been very vocal in calling for privatizing Social Security. In his budget, he calls for replacing Medicare with the voucher program for people under age 55. And basically calls for dismantling the federal government. I've been kind of surprised this hasn't gotten more attention because this is right in his budget. You know, these are projections that the Congressional Budget Office made based on Representative Ryan's instructions. And they show that if you pull out health care spending and Social Security, the rest of the budget is supposed to fall to about 4.5% of GDP by 2040 and 3.75% by 2050. Well, that includes military spending, which is currently about 4% GDP. So basically, by 2040, the rest of the federal government, you know, the Park Service, the Food and Drug Administration, the Education Department, everything we think of as the federal government pretty much is supposed to disappear under that proposal. You know, I assume he doesn't mean that, but that is what he wrote down. So these are extreme views. And, you know, again, Governor Romney isn't necessarily tied to everything that Representative Ryan puts on the table. On the other hand, you know, it was his choice to pick him. It's sort of like if you picked a hero from the Iraq War and then you said, well, you really disagreed with the war, that'd be kind of a strange thing to do.
What do you make of some of the hemming and hawing Mitt Romney's been doing about the proposals that have come from Representative Ryan in recent years regarding Medicare and privatization of Social Security? He seems one day to embrace those prescriptions for the economy, and the very next day he'll reverse himself. I guess not unfamiliar for the way Romney acts in terms of the politics that he practices.
Well, these are clearly unpopular positions. I mean, you know, I'm not a political scientist, but, you know, I do read polls like anyone else. And, you know, Social Security enjoys huge approval across the political spectrum. Republicans, conservatives, people identify themselves as Tea Party members, 70-80% support Social Security, don't want to see a cut. Same thing with Medicare, here lower, but again, just about the exact same thing. So, you know, when you throw those things on the table and you say, okay, well, do you stand behind them? If you're running for president, I won't think you want to be associated with them. On the other hand, there clearly are very conservative supporters of Governor Romney who are big contributors to the campaign, and I suspect those people would very much, excuse me, like to see Social Security and Medicare privatized.
Dean Baker, tell us specifically what the Ryan plan and what you know of Romney and his plans for his presidency, should he win, what would these two do to our current Medicare system?
Representative Ryan's budget, it's a little peculiar because he says, well, we're going to repeal, you know, President Obama's health care plan. So you get rid of that. So that means we'll get rid of those cuts. Also some benefits, you know, so the donut hole was filled in under the Medicare plan. And there's no copay for preventive care under the Affordable Care Act. So I think he's getting rid of that. I mean, if you're repealing the Affordable Care Act outright, then presumably that means that. But he also is getting rid of the cost controls. But then he says, well, we are going to save the same $716 billion, but he doesn't specify at all how. Now, Governor Romney's been asked about that, and someone pointed out to me, because I didn't realize this, they just put up a blog post this weekend that said, well, that's not my plan. I'm not going to have any cuts, or at least at the moment, at least I'm not proposing cuts to Medicare over the next decade. So that seems to be a difference between, you know, Representative Ryan's plan and what Governor Romney is at least saying at the moment. Now, in both cases, they are talking about beginning their voucher program, or they like to call premium support, beginning in 2022 or 2023. I think they might move it out a year. And under that system, people would get a voucher, which they could use to buy, in principle, a Medicare-equivalent policy. Whether that would be sufficient to afford to cover the cost of Medicare-equivalent policy remains to be seen, because, again, the research, and there's been a lot to date. I mean, we have private insurers operating within Medicare under the Medicare Advantage program now, and prior to that in the Gingrich Congress, the Medicare Plus Choice system. The experience with that has been it's raised costs. It doesn't lower costs, so one would be skeptical, I think, whether those vouchers would be sufficient to cover a plan, a Medicare-equivalent plan.
So when it comes to getting these facts before the American people, before the election, what kind of job has the media done in terms of separating fact from fiction, in terms of what these two parties, these two candidates are offering?
I think they've been, to a large extent, they've been almost useless. I mean, they seem to think it's their job to simply report what candidates say and, you know, just give you a kind of he said, she said. Well, President Obama said X and Governor Romney said Y. And then, you know, they go home and go see their kids or whatever, have a drink, whatever it is they do. And, you know, I just find that kind of incredible, because people reading the paper, even people are trying to be informed readers, they don't have time to go looking up, you know, Governor Romney says his plan does X. You know, Obama says that's not true. Well, you know, the typical person, they're coming home after a day of work. They don't have time to go and look up which is true. And just telling them one said X and the other one said Y when they can't both be true, that's really not doing a service. I mean, these people, at least, you know, the people at the New York Times, National Public Radio, they get paid decent salaries. This is their job. And, you know, frankly, I think they should be fired if all they do is a he said, she said. Why do you need to, you can get a high school kid paying the minimum wage to do that. You don't need a skilled reporter to just put down what Governor Romney says when he goes out and gives a talk and then what President Obama says.
That was Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. His latest book is titled The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. Find links to more information and analysis on the debate over Medicare on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Cuts to vital local, state, and federal programs, including education, health care, police, fire, and sanitation, have become increasingly visible since the economic meltdown that struck the U.S. in 2008. As businesses have suffered during the severe recession, tax dollars have dried up, often forcing governments to make up the shortfall by cutting budgets or eliminating public services altogether. Stimulus funds initially distributed by Washington to local and state governments that helped bridge the gap early on in the recession have also disappeared, with the GOP House adhering to their austerity ideology, refusing to allocate additional funds. But a new report from the Institute for Policy Studies titled Executive Excess 2012, The CEO Hands in Uncle Sam's Pocket, links the record-breaking compensation packages received by many of the nation's top corporate executives to our nation's tax code, full of loopholes and complicated gimmicks, enabling many giant companies to pay little or no federal tax. The report details how some tax rules encourage corporations to compensate their executives at unconscionably higher multitudes of what their average workers are paid, while other tax policies provide direct and indirect incentives to CEOs to aggressively search for new ways to reduce their annual corporate taxes. Your reporter spoke with Scott Klinger, an associate fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies, who is a co-author of the latest Executive Excess Report. Here, Klinger summarizes the data researched in the new study and offers some tax policy reform proposals that could reverse the trend in corporate tax avoidance and ever higher CEO compensation.
We identified four tax breaks or tax loopholes that allow corporations to benefit from the more pay they shovel towards their CEOs and other executives. These four loopholes annually cost the U.S. Treasury $14.4 billion, which is $46 for every man, woman, and child in the United States. It's also enough to rehire 211,000 of the school teachers that have been laid off, or to provide health insurance for 7 million kids that don't have it. So it's a big commitment that the country is making to giving companies rewards for paying executives too much. The biggest part of this loophole comes from just the general deductions that companies can make of their executive pay. Now, corporate tax law allows companies to deduct reasonable business expenses, and so we really want to see them put the term reasonable on executive pay in terms of the deductions they allow. They no longer allow deductions for skyboxes or Super Bowl tickets paid for above the face price of them, because those are deemed unreasonable. And we think there's a certain level of CEO pay that should be deemed unreasonable, especially when some executives are making more than $100 million a year.
In terms of this report, you also talk directly about how the tax code not only subsidizes but encourages corporations and the board of directors of these corporations to direct incredibly large sums of money towards their CEOs. And that has to do in part with the performance of these CEOs in reducing corporate tax rates, right?
Yes. There was an attempt during Bill Clinton's presidency in 1996 to rein in executive pay and to cap the deduction at $1 million. And before that bill could make its way through the House and Senate, it was amended to allow an exception for pay that was deemed to be performance-based. That is, that it went up if the company did well. And so what do you think happened? Well, what happened was pretty much all pay became performance-based. We saw a huge explosion in stock options and things called non-equity compensation plans, which give performance rewards if companies meet certain targets. In many cases, the targets were very low. It was like shooting fish in a barrel. But nonetheless, all of this pay became deductible, and they hoped it would be a control mechanism, and it actually just became a big gaping loophole. So, like, the highest CEO that we calculated was paid $78 million of performance-based pay, and all of it was deductible. That was the CEO of Oracle, the business software company.
Well, Scott Klinger, as we conclude here, I know as in past executive excess reports, you talk about some prescriptions for change, how reforming the tax code in certain ways could reduce the executive excess and take away the subsidies that we as taxpayers give to these enormously high compensation packages for these powerful and wealthy CEOs.
Yeah, there's a variety of prescriptions in the report. One is to actually eliminate the loophole for the performance pay deductions. That would save about $100 billion over the next 10 years. It's a very important deduction. We're expecting some legislation probably in the next month or so. So maybe we can keep an eye out for that and come back and talk about it when that happens. The other is a bill that would end corporate tax dodging. So these companies that get away with paying very little or no taxes, if they had their tax loopholes and tax haven loopholes closed, that would prevent that from happening. There's a very good bill that was introduced by Senator Levin from Michigan and Senator Conrad from North Dakota called the Cut Unjustified Tax Loopholes Act, or the Cut Loopholes Act is the short acronym of it. And it would block tax haven abuse. It would also end another deduction, which we didn't have time to talk about, but companies get very large deductions when they pay their executives with stock options. And Facebook saved billions of dollars when they came public. Though the stock has been a disappointment from a tax standpoint, they made billions of dollars, saved billions of dollars in taxes when they became public because Mark Zuckerberg and the other executives were all paid in stock. And then the third thing is just, I think, more transparency. There's two pieces that we're very concerned about. One is the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Bill, which passed 2 years ago. Had a provision requiring companies to publish the ratio between the CEO and the lowest paid worker. And companies have fought this tooth and nail. You think they were, you know, that we were asking them to do something that would put them out of business. But all we're asking is for a little information on the ratio, the divide within corporations. The other is for better tax disclosure of their tax, what they pay in taxes. Every year we publish a study or others do studies, and corporations are always arguing that's not, you don't have the numbers right, that's not right, and journalists will turn around and ask them, well, what is the right number, and can you show us your tax returns, or can you prove it? And they say, no, can't show you. So we really need better information. We need some plain English disclosures in the annual reports that companies file. We had this similar problem years ago with CEO pay. Every time someone would say what a CEO made, the companies would argue about it. The SEC stepped in and said, no, you have to do standard reports written in plain English. And now those disputes are very, very rare about how much a CEO made.
That was Scott Klinger,
associate fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies and co-author of the group's new report, Executive Excess 2012, The CEO Hands in Uncle Sam's Pocket. Find a link to the report and additional resources on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On August 12th, Unit 2 of the Millstone Nuclear Power Plant in Waterford, Connecticut, was shut down because the temperature of the ocean water used to cool elements of the reactor core was too high. Water in Long Island Sound reached a temperature of 75 degrees, causing the plant to go through an emergency shutdown and was still not operating as of a week later. This was the first such incident since the plant went online in 1975. Although nuclear plants in previous years have had to shut down due to the high temperature of fresh water in lakes and rivers, this is the first shutdown due to high ocean temperatures. A week before the shutdown, Millstone received authorization from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to take an average of 3 temperature measurements of water in the intake pipes for Unit 2, rather than using the single highest measure. Water temperatures in Long Island Sound this summer are the warmest on record, in line with the finding that July air temperatures have been the hottest recorded since record-keeping began in 1895. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with David Lockbaum, director of the Nuclear Safety Project of the Union of Concerned Scientists, an organization that is not opposed to nuclear power, just to its unsafe operation. He describes how a nuclear power plant's cooling system works, the impact such a system has on the surrounding aquatic environment, and how climate change could negatively affect the operation of nuclear reactors.
Nuclear power plants are 33% efficient, which means for every 3 units of energy produced by the reactor core, 1 unit of electricity is sent out on the transmission lines, and 2 units of energy must be dissipated to the environment as waste heat. That's why these power plants are built next to lakes, rivers, or oceans. They're the source of cooling water to carry away those 2 units of energy of thermal pollution. Nuclear power plants use lots of cooling water for that reason. That water leaves the plant up to 30 degrees warmer as it carries away that waste heat. And the large amounts of water and the higher temperatures have had effects on the local aquatic wildlife. There's no free lunch. That's part of the baggage that nuclear power plants have, is that they do have an impact on the environment from their operation.
If they return the water so much hotter, wouldn't that in itself contribute to heating up the water in the sound?
Yes. The thermal pollution discharge from an operating nuclear power plant does tend to warm up its nearby cooling water source and just aggravates an existing problem. And that's one of the reasons why either a reactor power reduction or shutdown is necessary to maintain the water temperature within the limits. One of the other odd or not intuitive consequences from a nuclear power plant discharging water 30 degrees above what it came in at is that the biggest danger sometimes to aquatic wildlife is when a plant shuts down, particularly in the winter where you're discharging very warm water. Fish and other things that are attracted by the warm water in that condition, and when the plant turns off, all of a sudden that 30 degrees warmer water almost instantly cools off, and the thermal shock has been detrimental to fish many times in many places.
Dave Lockbaum, Millstone is one of the plants that uses what's called a once-through water system, which creates these damaging impacts to aquatic life by heating up the water. Are there any other kinds of nuclear plants that do it better?
The Environmental Protection Act of 1972 required plants to use the best available technology. The best available technology is cooling towers, where the water is reused over and over again to the extent practical. So the hot water being discharged from a plant, instead of going back to the lake, river, ocean, goes through a cooling tower where air flowing through the tower removes the heat, and the cooled water can then be reused by the plant. The only need for water from the nearby lake, river, or ocean is to replace the vapor that's going out the top of the cooling tower. If you use a cooling tower, you reduce your water consumption by a factor of 10. You only use about 10% of the water that you'd use with once-through cooling. You're significantly reduce the impact on the aquatic wildlife because you're significantly reducing the amount of water you draw from that water body. There's been a debate over the recent years about plants that are extending their lives for 20 more years, whether they have to meet that regulation. When the regulation was adopted, many of the nuclear power plants in the United States that were already operating or being constructed were grandfathered from the new law, so they didn't have to have cooling towers. Now that their owners want to run those plants for 20 more years or 40 more years, there's a debate about whether they should be upgraded to better protect the environment from their operation.
What does it cost to put up a cooling tower?
To add a cooling tower to an existing plant would cost upwards of $100 million. That's a reason why the plant owners are a little bit reluctant to do it, when it would take them many years to recoup that investment. It also costs them money over the life of the plant, because you don't make as much electricity when you have cooling towers as you would when you're just drawing water from the ocean. So far, no U.S. plant has backfitted cooling towers. They've all either shut down or gotten continued waivers to continue operating. New nuclear power plants, or new power plants more generally, are built with cooling towers from the get-go.
You know, the first thing I thought of when I saw the reason they shut down Millstone was global warming, climate change. Does that figure in here? It seems like it would.
Yeah, the Millstone and other nuclear power plants are built and designed based on historical patterns of temperatures, precipitation, earthquakes, volcanic activity, and so on. All of that is looking backwards. What has been the history of those kind of natural conditions for the proposed site? They don't look forward. So when global warming causes temperatures to rise above what historical patterns have been, their margins may not be sufficient to protect them against global warming. So many have said that nuclear power can be an answer to global warming, but it's really reverse. We're going to have to solve global warming for nuclear power to have a future.
That was David Lockbaum, director of the Union of Concerned Scientists Nuclear Safety Project. To learn more about nuclear power safety issues and global warming, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.